Thanks so much, Mary. How's the sound? Can everyone hear? Yes. Excellent. We're in good shape. I feel a little bit like I've come back to my high school to read in the cafeteria. Mary, thank you so much for that introduction. I really appreciate it. And I'd like to thank the Thurber House for having me back. The weather didn't quite cooperate, but I don't know about you. I find this to be rather cozy here. And I hope I'll be able to deliver something that will be of pleasure to you. I can't help but remember when I was at the University of Nebraska doing my PhD work, the students had a reading series called the No Name Reading Series. And the readings took place that first year in a banquet room at Valentino's Pizza. And even though we thought no one would break in on us, from time to time over the PA system, you would hear, Smith, party of two, your pizza is ready. Okay, I'm going to read from River of Heaven. And I think I've got it arranged, so I'll only have to interrupt once to tell you what's transpiring in the pages that I don't read. And so we'll just jump in. I think everything will be self-explanatory. But I am curious, any owners of Basset Hounds in the room? Not a single Basset Hound owner in the room? You're going to want one after you hear this. Okay, this is River of Heaven. This evening, toward dusk, my neighbor, Arthur Pope, strides across the driveways that separate our houses, a casserole dish held between his hands. I see him through the kitchen window as I stand at the sink opening a can of Natural Balance duck and potato for my basset hound, Stump. I reach to switch off the light, but too late, Arthur has spotted me. I can tell by the way he lifts the casserole dish higher, extends it with his oven mitt-covered hands, and I have no choice but to wave at him and then go out into my side yard and open the gate. Ahoy, neighbor! A former Navy man, this is the way he talks. Unlike me, he's kept fit over the years. He still does calisthenics, even keeps a barbell set in his basement. A manly man with chest and shoulders and arms that aren't what they were 30 years ago, but still, they're impressive. A thick head of wavy gray hair, a bounce to his step. Time for mess. He bows his head over the casserole dish and sniffs. Andouille jambalaya, he says. Permission requested? To come aboard, sir. It's October, and the leaves have started to fall. Here in Mount Gilead, our small town in southern Illinois, we can burn them on Saturdays, air quality and the ozone layer be damned. We rake our leaves to the sides of our streets or onto our backyard gardens and set them to burn. The air smells of the must and the smoke the way it has this time of year as long as I can recall. Since I was a kid in Rat Town, that's what we've always called the neighborhood in the lowlands on the south edge of Mount Gilead, a mess of tumble-down houses. Each spring there, when the Wabash River rises, the floodwaters still come up to the doorsteps. I'm glad to be safe and dry here in Orchard Farms, this modest gathering of ranch homes on streets with names like Apple Blossom and Cherry Blossom, and peach tree. Arthur thinks he knows my life. Me, Sam Brady, a bachelor all my 65 years, and I wish I could believe that he does. He thinks he knows it because his dear wife, Bess, is now 6 months gone, and he imagines that we share the misery of men living alone. You and me, he said once not long after she died. He laid his hand on my shoulder. Jesus, Sammy, we're a pair. But my life is not his. I'd tell him this if I had the heart. I'd tell him I have no idea what it is to love someone all that time. Nearly 40 years he and Bess were married, and to lose them one day without warning, an aneurysm in her brain, "Arthur, my head hurts," she said. And in the next instant, she fell to the kitchen floor, already gone. All my adult life, I've lived alone, except for the dogs, the latest being Stump, who stands now at the screen door waiting for his duck and potato. "He gets contentious," I tell Arthur, nodding towards Stump. Nothing could be further from the truth. Like all basset hounds, Stump is long on patience, steadfast with his devotion, mild-tempered and affectionate. A perfect companion. His nose is up against the storm door glass. His velvety ears hang in loose folds, their ends curling slightly inward. He stares at me with his sad-ass eyes. "Stump," I say to Arthur. "He puts the hurt in me if he doesn't get his grub." "Don't we all?" Arthur lifts the casserole dish toward my nose. "Sailor, don't we all?" What can I do but let him into my house and tell him to set the casserole dish on the range? He tells me exactly how he made it, and I know what's coming next. "I could give you the recipe," he snaps his fingers. "Or you could come on down to the senior center. Now that's the ticket, and Sammy, you could learn to do for yourself." It's not the first time he's asked. He's learned to cook by joining a widower's group, the Seasoned Chefs. And every Wednesday evening, he goes downtown to the senior center and works up a new dish. But me? "Sorry, Arthur," I tell him. "No can do." For a moment, I'm tempted. I'll admit that. But then I think of myself trying to make conversation with all those men, widowers who have a genuine right to their loneliness, and I can't imagine it. You see, I'm a man who chooses to be alone. A man who has a secret. I'm a closet anti, a fag, a queer. You know all the words. Here in Mount Gilead, even in this day and age when the world is supposed to be more tolerant, more accepting, it's clear that many folks think this is a wrong thing to be. I see the graffiti spray painted on the sides of garbage dumpsters along alleys, on the bathroom walls at the city park, on the Salvation Army collection bins in the Walmart parking lot. Those words, I hear them on the lips of schoolboys and cocksure young men swaggering around the town and country lanes where I sometimes bowl a few lines. Even from people like Arthur, older men who still believe that naming something they fear puts it in a place where it can't hurt them. I've heard them all my life, these words. I've let them, for better or worse, make me a cautious man, on guard, well aware that danger always waits just around the corner. Stump bumps his nose into the back of my leg. I get down on a knee and scratch his ears. I let him sniff my face, give me a lick. I stare into those sad eyes. "I'm about to get busy," I say to Arthur. "Busy?" He stands with his hands on his hips. He still has on his oven mitts, and he looks, well, if you want the truth, he looks like a man afraid of his own hands. "Sammy," he says, but I cut him off before he can launch into what I know will be another attempt to persuade me not to be so much of a loner. "Winter's coming," I tell him. "I've got to build Stump a new house." "What's wrong with the one he's got?" "Oh, it won't do," I say, still looking into Stump's eyes. "Nope, not at all. Not for a dog like this." I start with a picture in my head. A kid's playhouse I saw once years ago in a backyard in a town I was passing through on my way to somewhere else. I'd never seen anything like it, that house, made in the shape of a sailing ship, hull and deck and mast and crow's nest, something out of Peter Pan. What a sight, this ship, all for the sake of a kid, some lucky kid. I had to pull over to the curb, had to sit there and talk myself out of going into that backyard, walking past the playhouse up to the real house, a house of brick and bay windows. I wanted to put my face up to one of those windows just for the chance to get a glimpse of the miraculous life I imagined going on inside. I spend weeks drawing up the plans for Stump Ship. I while away several pleasant days at the public library studying how to build the curved hull, the castle tower, the stern wheel, the crow's nest. Then I gather my lumber and tools and I get to work. "You got it all wrong," Arthur says to me one afternoon when he comes to watch me in the side yard with my saws and hammer and nails. I've caught him on certain afternoons peeking out his window, and now he's finally come to tell me exactly what he thinks. I'm nailing together the hull, overlapping the planks the way you would a clapboard house. "That's a clinker hull," he says. "Now, sailor, how in the hell are you going to cut cannon ports in a clinker hull? What you want is a carvel hull, the planks all flush and even. Then you'll be in business." "Cannon ports?" I stop driving nails. The air, after all that pop, 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 clears out, and I watch a lone maple leaf come drifting down, twirling and then floating until it finally settles on Stump, who's sleeping in the sun. "Why would I want cannon ports?" Arthur narrows his eyes, sets his jaw, tips back his head. "Sailor," he says, "what if Seaman Stump suffers an enemy attack?" Then he gives me a wink, and it almost breaks my heart, because I know he's telling me he's lonely. I know he's asking me to please play along. What he wants more than anything now is to help me build this ship, to have my company to help him pass the hours, and I'm willing to grant him that. Stump is lolled over on his side, the maple leaf stuck to his white belly, but he doesn't know it. His legs are up in the air, and one of them twitches, the only sign that he might have felt that leaf at all, but he keeps snoozing, belly full, warming in the sun. "Arthur," I say, and I say this in all earnestness, careful not to hurt his feelings, "I've never known Stump to be the fighting kind." "Sailor," Arthur says, "do you want to be authentic or not?" "A carvel hull," I say, imagining the two of us working together. "Let me grab my carpenter's apron," he says, and apparently I want to be authentic because I don't stop him. And the next thing I know, we're pulling off the planks and starting over. We work, for the most part, without talking, falling into a comfortable rhythm of measuring and sawing and nailing. We put a pet door into the hull so Stump can enter, and we design a gangway so he can waddle up to the top deck. The promenade, Arthur insists I call it, with as much dignity as a basset hound can manage. We cut a hatch into the deck and equip it with another pet door so Stump can move back and forth from the hull to the deck. He can be topside or he can go below. I catch on to the sailor's lingo. Pretty soon I'm talking about fore and aft, bow and stern, port and starboard. "Steady as she goes," I say to Arthur as we raise the mast tower, and he says to me, "That's it. Now you're getting your legs." I let him cut cannon ports in the hull and rig them with hinge shutters that we can prop open or close. Stump, when he's below deck, sticks his face out a cannon port and sniffs the air. "Ahoy," I say to him, and he barks. Then, one day toward evening, we're finished. For a moment, we stand in the last of daylight, admiring our work, and pleased that I am. Already I miss the way the hours have so pleasantly unfolded with Arthur. "I've got a surprise," he says. "It's over at the house. I'll be right back." While he's gone, Stump sniffs around the perimeter of the ship, and I imagine he's trying to make up his mind about such a thing. Then Arthur's back, and he has a flag. "The lady who teaches the seasoned chefs stitched it for me," he says. He unfolds it, and I see that it's a Jolly Roger of sorts. Only, instead of a skull, there's Stump's face. And below it, the crossbones are milk-bone dog biscuits. Not too authentic. I can't resist saying to Arthur, well, he says, who's to notice except us old sea dogs? He gets up on deck with a stepladder and hangs the flag from the mast tower. Then he comes back to where I'm standing, and we put our hands on our hips and tip back our heads to study that flag furling and popping in the wind. Stump lifts a leg and pees on the stern. Looks like he's christened it, Arthur says with a laugh. Now all it needs is a name. I don't even give it a thought. How about we call her the Bess? For a long time, Arthur doesn't say a word. He just keeps looking up at that flag. His eyes close for an instant, then he opens them and says, that's what you want. It is, I tell him. This may not seem like much, this story I'm telling, but you have to understand what it is to be me, a man who has always been afraid of himself. You have to know the rest of my story, the part I can't yet bring myself to say, a story of a boy I knew a long time ago and a brother I loved and then lost. I'm sorry. But for now, I'm afraid all I can give you is this picture of me moving through the twilight as I fetch a can of red paint from my basement. I hand a brush to Arthur, and he takes it, his eyes meeting mine, both of us unashamed of how sentimental this all is. He kneels down along the prow of this ship, the House of Stump, and with great care, he paints the first stroke, the bristles of the brush folding back with a slow, steady grace that stirs me on this evening near to winter. I know this is as close as I've come in some time to living by heart. And what shakes me is the understanding that this is as close as I may ever come, this moment already beginning to fade here on dry land. It isn't long before the local newspaper, the Daily Mail, gets wind of Stump's ship. And one morning, a reporter calls, a young man, at least he sounds young to me on the phone, who says he'd like to do a story about this ship I've built for my dog. Stump paws at my foot as if to say that should I see fit to hand him the telephone, he'd be glad to tell this reporter how much his new ship suits him. It sounds awesome, Mr. Brady, the reporter says. Just the sort of human interest story our readers would enjoy. Oh, it's not that interesting, I say, but I can't deny I'm flattered. I was hoping I could stop by this afternoon, snap some photos, ask you a few questions. We'd like to run something in our It's Us section. In the newspaper, I ask. Although I know the section he's talking about. Every Friday, it offers profiles of people with unusual hobbies and whatnot. Like I said, Mr. Brady, it's an interesting story, right up our alley. Shall we say 1 o'clock? I've always taken an interest in those features. Looked forward, even, to the Friday paper and what I might find out about someone. The man who built a pioneer village on his farm just outside town. Built with his own hands a jail, a saloon, a one-room schoolhouse, a library, and blacksmith pottery and candle shops. The woman who runs a foster home for injured or orphaned albino squirrels. Our claim to fame in this town we bill as the home of the white squirrels. The blind man who 40 years ago gold-plated a Coca-Cola glass but never could convince the company to patent the idea, so there it was, one of a kind, and he couldn't even see it. I went to the auction they held at his house after he died and bought a box of odds and ends, old tins of shoe polish, a hairbrush, a collapsible drinking cup, and wouldn't you know it? There it was, buried down deep in that box, that gold-plated Coca-Cola glass, tossed there like it was a piece of junk. I keep it in my basement, afraid to leave it out in plain view in case someone might take a notion to make off with it. "Those photos," I say, "would you take one of my dog? The two of you together? And that ship? We gotta see that ship." The notion of a photo of me and Stump and his ship tickles me. I might even clip it from the paper and carry it in my wallet so when we meet someone while we're out on our evening walks, I can take it out and say to this someone, "Look, it's us." Or maybe I'm just pretending. Maybe I'd never be able to do that at all. "Better make it 2:30, I say. Stump always likes a nap right after his lunch. Indeed, the reporter turns out to be young, a tall, lanky boy with arms too long for the sleeves of his corduroy sport coat. His hair is cut short in what we used to call a burr. His scalp shines beneath the bristle, and I try to imagine what it would feel like to rub my hand over his head. "Mr. Brady?" He uses the eraser of his pencil to push his eyeglasses, which have too much play in them, up on the bridge of his nose. "I'm from the paper, sir. We spoke on the phone?" What happened, I wonder, to proper introductions? "Hello, my name is..." "I'm Sam Brady," I say, and I stick out my hand. The boy tries to meet my offer with his own hand so we can shake the way gents do when they first meet, but he fumbles his pencil and it drops to the floor of my porch. We both bend over, reaching for the pencil, and our heads touch. Not with a bang, but with a gentle brush of skin on skin, my own skull shiny and bald, and I'm delighted to know that his bristly hair isn't bristly at all, but has the feel of velvet. "It's 2:30, he says, as if that will do as an introduction, this reminder of our agreed-upon meeting time. "And you are?" I say. I see him grimace, a tightening of the lips for just a moment, an involuntary frown he hasn't intended for public display. Then he says, "Duncan." "Duncan, how much?" I say, the way that men my age do in this part of the country. Again, the boy momentarily grits his teeth. Then he says it, as much as I can see he hates to. "Hines," he says. "My name is Duncan Hines." There, now, we've got that out in the open, just like the cake mix. That's me. Go ahead, take all the time you need to laugh. It's another bright day, one of the last before we make the final turn to winter. From where I stand on the porch, I can see the prow of Stump's ship, and it excites me to think that folks are about to take notice. The old Duncan Hines slogan comes to me, and I can't stop myself. I blurt it out. "So rich, so moist, so very Duncan Hines." Then I'm embarrassed because what kind of thing is that for a grown man to say to this boy I don't know from Adam? If he takes offense or thinks it odd, he doesn't show it. Let's just say my parents had a sense of humor. "Now, about this ship you've built for your dog." I tell him to follow me. We come down the porch steps and I open the gate into the side yard. Stump is there, and he yaps a couple of times before I tell him to keep the sass to himself. "This young fella's about to make you famous," I tell him. And Duncan Hines gets down on his knees, not giving a snap about his nice khaki-colored slacks and what the grass and the dirt might do to them. "Well, looky here," he says, giving Stump a scratch behind his ears. "You're some dog." "Sometimes I think he knows it," I say. "Why, sure he does. You betcha. What I wouldn't give for a dog like you." Duncan Hines gets up from his knees and he lifts his arm towards Stump's ship. "That's something," he says. "Boy, it sure is." "That's a carvel haul," I say, trying not to toss the term around too smugly like I'm a know-it-all. "A carvel haul," Duncan Hines says, and he writes it down on his notepad. Then I'm telling him all about how I built the ship, built the hull and the promenade and the mast and the crow's nest. "See those cannon ports?" I say. I glance over and see him write down the words "cannon ports." "Won't those come in handy," I say, "if Seaman Stump ever comes under enemy attack?" "You don't mean to say there's actually a cannon in the hold of that ship?" For a moment, I consider letting him believe it's true, but I confess that I'm only joking. He rubs his hand over his velvety head, and I see a blush come into his face. I imagine I can tell him anything, and he'll believe me. That's the sort he is, the perfect sort for the human interest profiles he writes. A curious, eager boy. He's only 19, I find out. A student at the community college who writes the It's Us stories for the Daily Mail, ready for the world to amaze him. I tell him I'm thinking of installing a heating system in the hold of the ship so Stump can spend winter days and nights there if he takes a mind to. Duncan Hines writes it all down, what I plan to do, the story of how I got the idea, that kid's playhouse, the way I puzzled out how to build it. You did all this by yourself? I want to say yes, yes indeed, I did. But just then, Arthur comes out of his house and waves his arm in greeting. Ahoy, he says, and starts toward us. My neighbor, I say, Arthur, he helped me. For a good while, I don't have to say a word because Arthur is only too glad to tell Duncan Hines all about the time he spent in the Navy, what he knows about nautical history, and how he was glad to contribute his expertise to the building of Stump's ship. I get the feeling that I could disappear, sink right into the ground, and neither Arthur nor Duncan would notice. Then I realize that Duncan has asked me a question, one that I didn't fully register, and I have to say, I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Come again? I ask you if you've always lived in Mount Gilead. Sammy grew up in Rat Town, Arthur says. Didn't you, Sammy? Yes, I say, that's right, Rat Town. But I've lived here in Orchard Farms a long time. Arthur and I have been neighbors a good number of years. My family came from Rat Town, Duncan Hines says. My mom's side, anyway. Who were your people? I ask. My grandmother was a Finn. She married a man they called Grinny, but his real name was Norval, Norval Hines. All the while I'm posing with Arthur and Stump for the photo Duncan takes, I'm stunned. I didn't even know there were any Finns left hereabouts. I can't imagine what I look like. Standing here on one side of the ship's prow, Arthur on the other side, and Stump on the deck at the point between us. Perfect, Duncan says, but I don't feel that way at all. Recalling the story of Dewey Finn, a boy who lived next door to me in Rat Town, a boy I've done my best to leave behind me for good. I stand here now, the thought of him more than I can bear, wondering exactly what Duncan knows. Dewey Finn died on a Friday evening in April. This was in 1955, and now this boy Duncan has brought back the feeling of what it was like to get the news. By the time the word reached Rat Town, the rain that had been falling 3 days straight had let up, but we knew there was more on the way. The river was rising, and we feared that overnight the floodwaters would spill over the streets and spread across the yards. I was with my father, helping him build a sandbag levee around our house, when the sheriff, Hersey Dawes, pulled his patrol car to the side of our street, opened the door, and came up onto the sidewalk. My father stuck his shovel into the sand pile and leaned on the handle, 1 foot resting on the blade. "Someone in trouble?" he called to Hersey. And Hersey came into our yard and told us what he would soon have to tell Snuff and Betty Finn. Dewey was dead. This boy with wild red hair and freckles across his nose, this skinny boy with green eyes and long lashes and a smile that always put me at ease, Dewey Finn. Hersey was a sturdy man, broad-shouldered and big-chested, and for years it had been his job to deal with the sort of business that would bring most men to their knees. I could see, though, that this was something that shook even him, and he was relieved to have this excuse for putting off for just a while what he would eventually have to carry to the Finns. "Jesus, Bill," he said to my father, and then he bit his lip and shook his head. He closed his eyes for a second, and I knew he was trying to forget wherever it was he'd just come from and what he'd seen. "Right now, I'd let you have this job for a song." My father was a good-natured man with black hair that he combed straight back and held in place with Lucky Tiger tonic. He worked in the mill room at the Kex tire plant, and he carried a buck knife in a leather scabbard clipped to his belt. At work, he used that knife to cut slabs of rubber as they came off the mill drum. But on this night, he was using it to slice links of twine that I tied around the gunny sacks we were filling with sand. "I wouldn't want it, Hersey," my father said. "Not for $1 million. I can't even imagine doing what you're going to have to do." Hersey took a breath and drew back his shoulders, and I understood he was practicing on us before he went on to the Finns. "Just after 6, he said. "The B&O National Limited passenger train took the curve north of town, and there at the trestle, too late for the engineer to apply the brakes, lay Dewey on the tracks as if he'd stretched out for a nap. You wouldn't want to see what a train can do to a body," Hersey said. "I can tell you that." "No, I don't imagine," my father said. And then we all stood there, not saying a word. Finally, Hersey looked toward the Finn's house, that square house with the asphalt shingle siding and a little peaked roof over the front step. Dusk was coming on, and someone had switched on a light inside. I saw one of Dewey's sisters, Nancy, I thought it was, pass by an open window. A radio was playing, that snappy tune, "Hey, Mr. Banjo," by the Sunnysiders. It was date night, and soon the boys would be coming for the Finn girls. "I've said too much." Hersey shook his head. "I shouldn't be talking like this, not in front of Sammy." He turned to me then. "Do you know any reason why Dewey would go and do something like this? Put himself in the way of that train?" I told him I didn't. Then Hersey asked me whether I'd been with Dewey after school. "Everyone knew we were friends," he said. Had I been with Dewey? Had I talked to him? Had I picked up on anything that might explain why he'd feel so miserable that he'd put himself across those tracks and wait for that train? "No, sir," I said. I held a burlap sack open while my father tipped a shovel of sand into it. The sack sagged with the sand's weight, and I felt the strain in my forearms. "I never saw Dewey today," I said. "Just at school, that's all." The truth was, I'd seen him just after supper, head off for the B&O railroad tracks that ran behind Rat Town. It was where the two of us often went in the evenings just to get off by ourselves, to be away from our houses where there was always too much going on. Dewey's sisters fighting over who got to play the radio, my mother yapping at my father for drinking too many Falstaffs and never taking her uptown to bingo at the fire hall and later a piece of pie at the Verlaine Cafe. Some evenings, Dewey and I sat on the railroad trestle and talked about everything we wanted once we got old enough and rich enough to have it. Dewey wanted a Chevy Bel Air with a chopped top, Frenched headlights, and lake pipes. Then he said he'd get the hell out of Rat Town. Never look back. "I swear, Sammy, just go. That's what I'll do. Just go wherever I take a mind to." I wanted to be a singer. It makes me laugh to remember that now. But then I thought it would be swell to be a singer in a white dinner jacket and a bow tie, my hair like my father's, shiny with Lucky Tiger. Dewey and I sang together those nights on the trestle, even though neither of us had a voice. We sang songs we'd heard on Your Hit Parade. "Sincerely," "Moments to Remember," "The Shifting Whispering Sands." We were miserable at it, but we didn't care. Who could hear? It was just the two of us, legs swinging back and forth as they dangled over the trestle. Across the fields, we could see the houses we'd eventually have to go back to, but for the time being, we felt far away from them, and we lifted up our voices and sang. "This is the place I feel the best," he told me once. "Right here, with you." I got this funny feeling in my stomach then, funny in a good way, the way it was when I was riding in my brother's 49 Ford coupe, and he took a hill too fast, and we came down the other side with a dip that made me say, "Oh, doctor," And I told Dewey, me too. The evening he died, my father and I watched Hersey Dawes go into the Finn's house, and we listened as the radio went dead. Such an eerie quiet. And I knew Hersey was filling it with his news. Soon, he came out of the house and drove away in his car. They start to come. People I don't know. All through November and into December, they come. They drive slowly past my house, stop on occasion and sit in their cars, pointing at Stump's ship. If he happens to be on board, someone might come to the fence and baby talk him. Somebody else might start in with the sailing lingo. "Aye, Cap'n," I hear a boy say this evening. The sun is setting, dipping down below the power lines and maple trees, their bare branches dark against what's left of the light. I remember what the old-timers used to say when the sun set red. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. I'm in the garage checking the antifreeze in my Jeep Cherokee, and through the six small glass panes that stretch across the top of the garage door, I can see the sun break apart as it sinks below the trees. Orange streaks the sky, which is a darker shade of blue now, a blue close to purple this near to dark. The boy is maybe 10 or so, a boy I've seen in the neighborhood, but no one I know to call by name. He wears a sock hat, not a tight-fitting watch cap like sailors wear, but a loose one with a tail that hangs down his neck, a white yarn ball at the end resting between his shoulders. He snaps off a salute to Stump, who is unimpressed. Stump slowly tips back his head to watch a white squirrel skittering along a power line, his glorious tail curving out behind him. Another dog would set up a howl and tear across the yard to tell that squirrel to vacate the premises immediately. But not Stump. He calmly watches the world go by. Even this boy, yakking at him from the fence, is nothing he can't tolerate. A pirate walks into a bar. The boy is telling Stump a joke now, not caring whether someone might come by and hear him. I imagine this is a joke the boy has taken a fancy to, and now he simply wants to hear the sound of it coming from his mouth. A pirate walks into a bar, he says, with a steering wheel down his pants. Okay, I'm hooked. Charmed, you might say, by the ridiculous premise. I'm eavesdropping, and I don't feel guilty because, after all, this is my dog the boy has decided to entertain. He acts it all out, thrusting his narrow pelvis forward as if he's got that steering wheel right where the pirate does. Bartender says, "Buddy, you got a steering wheel down your pants." The boy scrunches up his face into what he must feel a wizened old pirate with a steering wheel in his cargo bay would look like. "Arg," the pirate says, "and it's driving me nuts." Always go for the cheap laugh. I can't help myself. I laugh. I laugh over the silly joke and the boy's joyful telling. I laugh with more gusto than I have in years, and the boy hears me. He looks toward the garage where he must see my face pressed close to the glass, and all I can think to do is to wave. He waves back. Then he turns and runs down the street, the tail of his sock hat trailing behind him. So this is where I have to pause and catch you up before I read the final scene that I'm going to read today. Because of the article that appears in the newspaper, Sammy's brother, Cal, who has been estranged from him ever since the death of Dewey Finn and has been living in the great state of Ohio, comes back to Mount Gilead and comes back into Sammy's life. One night, Sammy and Cal and Arthur go to the seasoned chef's cooking class. And that evening, Duncan Hines is also attending because he's doing a human interest story on the seasoned chefs. At the end of the night, Cal sees Duncan Hines talking to Sammy. And once Cal and Sammy are alone back at Sammy's house, he wants to know what they were talking about. And here's the final scene. "What did he want with you?" Cal asks when we're finally alone in my house. "That Duncan Hines. He wanted to talk about Dewey." "Good Christ. What did you tell him?" "Nothing. Honest, Cal, I didn't tell him a thing." I try to keep my voice steady, but I'm certain Cal can hear how much Duncan has me on edge. But it's going to come out. Not if we don't tell it. Maybe we should tell it. Tell the whole thing. "Don't talk like that. Keep talking like that, and I'll get in my truck and leave. Leave me alone to face it, just like you did all those years ago." I make my voice go hard, trying to cover the desperation I feel now that I'm convinced Duncan is on to something. "You owe it to me to stay this time. You know that, don't you? Surely you won't leave me again. Please, Cal, I don't know how much longer I can keep everything to myself." I stop talking, hoping that he'll say the next thing and give me the assurance I want. When he doesn't, I go on. "What I'm saying is I need you here with me the same way I needed you then." He takes a deep breath and lets it out before squaring his shoulders and giving me a nod. "I'll take it on," he says. "You understand what I'm saying? I'll be the one to stand up to the truth if the time comes when we need to. Until then, you keep your mouth shut. Got it?" "All right," I say. He looks me in the eye for what seems like a very long time. Then he says, "Sometimes I think that night with Dewey made my whole life." Mine too. Made it something I didn't want it to be. Sent me out on a road that ended up in Ohio. "Now you're home. Now it's you and me." "Good Christ, Sammy." He lets loose a ragged sigh. And I know the weight of his living as well as I know my own. It warms me to know that he's willing to stand beside me in the face of whatever's coming. Tonight, having him in my house means the world to me. Christmas will soon be here, and for the first time in years, I'll spend it with my brother. I remember the way Christmas was in Rat Town, the way it was before Dewey died. Before Cal left, I remember snow falling and the smell of coal smoke from people's chimneys and the tangerines my father brought home in paper sacks from the little farm market. My mother taped Christmas cards to the door frame that led from our front room to our kitchen, and she baked cookies and divinity and fudge. Each year, my father and I went off into the woods behind the railroad trestle, and we cut a cedar tree and brought it home and set it up by our front window. I remember coming down the street at night. Maybe I'd been to a basketball game at school or to the Verlaine to see what new records might be on the jukebox. And I'd see the lights on our tree. And I'd hurry, anxious to be home, out of the cold, where my father had the radio on. Burl Ives might be singing Frosty the Snowman, or Gene Autry might be doing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and my mother was wrapping packages. "Don't peek," she'd say, as I came through the door, and make a big show of covering over whatever she happened to have on the drop-leaf table. I remember all that. Such a feeling of being in the right place with the right people. I remember what it was to have a family. Thank you.